Hi, welcome back to Truth or Talk. Thanks for hanging in with us. Today we're talking to James Corbett. James has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started the Corbett Report website in 2007 as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. The Corbett Report is an independent, listener-supported alternative news source. It operates on the principle of open source intelligence and provides podcasts, interviews, articles, and videos about breaking news and important issues, from 9/11 truth and false flag terror to the Big Brother police state, eugenics, geopolitics, the central banking fraud, and much, much more. Please welcome to the show, James Corbett. Hi, James. Thank you for being on today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, nice to meet you. One of the things we would like to know about you is, tell us about your journey to becoming awake, and why did you decide to start your show?
Well, the story starts, I guess, the way I usually tell it starts in 2006, and I think there may have been parts of my journey that started before then, kind of planting the seeds, but really in 2006 is when I started to encounter some of the information that really became the research that became the Corbett Report. So I moved into a new apartment here in Japan, and that apartment came with an internet connection, and it was the first time in years that I'd had an internet connection in my home. And in my absence, I'd suddenly discovered all of these new things that were coming up online, like YouTube and Google Video and things for basically allowing me to explore my interests in documentaries and things like that to my heart's extent. So I started getting into that. I've always been sort of a politically interested person, so I was looking at politically interested videos, I guess you could say. And then I started to encounter in the related videos on YouTube these crazy wild ideas about 9/11 conspiracy theories and things of that nature. And I clicked on some of them just out of curiosity, and some of them were silly and outrageous and just made me roll my eyes, but others had little facts that I thought were interesting. And this being the internet age, I could actually go and search some of those facts for myself and see if there was anything to them. And once you get started in that process, as I'm sure your audience will know, it's just a rock that's rolling downhill, and it just gathers steam from that point. So ultimately, it was only about 6 to 8 months maybe from that initial encounter with that type of information towards starting the website. And it was really just a spontaneous decision on my part. I knew I had to get this information out to other people. And at first I was thinking about physically handing CDs out to people of podcasts I'd listen to or something of that sort. But then I'm like, well, that's ridiculous. I'm in Japan, so I only have a limited access to English speakers anyway. So I decided, well, it's the internet age, I better start a website. And so I did. And it was originally just going to be a podcast. But very soon I realized, well, I should do articles, I should do videos, I have to do interviews. So it just became what it is, really just sort of spontaneously, and there was no grand plan behind it, and it's far exceeded anything I could have ever imagined when I made that first little step.
Wow, you know, that's so fascinating, because I feel a lot of people, we ask a lot of our guests this question, and a lot of them had some kind of harsh, I don't know, some traumatic event in their life that made them kind of look in and seek this information out. But that's just, I'm just fascinated by the fact that you were just very open, you know, to the possibility.
Well, yeah, and that's why I say it may have started before 2006, because I think there are little incidents that I can point back to as you go, oh, maybe that's why I was kind of already receptive to this idea. I had always sort of known, for example, that clearly Lee Harvey Oswald didn't kill JFK by himself. That's a ridiculous story. But I never really, I never got into JFK assassination research or anything of that sort. I just kind of knew that was a load of hogwash. And things of that nature. I've always been kind of skeptical about things like that, but I'd never really done a lot of research into it. But in 2006, I was going back to Canada from Japan for a trip to be the best man in my friend's wedding, and passing through customs in Vancouver, I got stopped and pulled aside for extra screening, And I'd never really been through that experience. It was more than I was expecting. Not only did they go through all my bags and take everything out and look at it, but they started doing things like taking the book out of my bag and asking me, oh, do you like this book? And it was really loaded with significance, like this answer to this. And it was just a Chuck Palahniuk novel. It was nothing. I mean, it wasn't some, you know, terrorist manual. Yeah. Exactly. But I mean, it felt like somehow my answer to this question would determine whether or not I'm a terrorist or something like that. It was a really, really uncomfortable vibe. And then they took out my cell phone and they were going through the pictures in my cell phone. And it was a brand new cell phone, so I only had 5 or 6 pictures on it. And they're like, well, why don't you have so many? Why do you only have 5 or 6 pictures? And then they were asking me, who is this person? Who is that person? It was so bizarre. And then they got out my diary, my journal, and were flipping through it. And she asked me, Can I take a photocopy of this or something like that? And I was flabbergasted. I'm like, I don't know. Can you? I had no idea what my rights were in that situation, what I could or couldn't consent to. I was completely blown away by that whole process. And so I think that obviously shook me up pretty badly. I mean, I'd always had kind of I think everyone has a bit of a dislike of that type of idea of that screening and searching and what have you. But a lot of people can kind of go along with it because, oh, you know, it's the age of terror or whatever. But that when it hits home like that and you are experiencing that yourself, you really do start to think, well, what are your rights in that situation? And what can these people do? And what kind of legal limbo are you in that? And so that got some of the wheels turning. And another incident that I point back to was when I was, I think, first in Japan, I was watching the biopic of Gandhi. And there's a scene in that where Gandhi is in South Africa and the Indians are required to carry their identity cards with them. As part of, you know, the British rule there. And so Gandhi leads a protest of people against this idea of having to carry your identity card everywhere and, you know, gets beaten up for it and thrown in jail and everything. And there I am sitting there watching this movie with my identity card in my pocket because all foreigners, all residents of Japan have to have an identity card at all times. If you're stopped any time by a policeman, they can ask for that identity card. And I was sitting there. Well, I was sitting there thinking, well, why is this so normal to me? Why did I never even question this, let alone, you know, protest it and get beaten up and thrown in jail for it? I mean, we've really undergone some conditioning in the past century to truly transform our ideas of issues like this. And that was another kind of eye-opening incident that at least got me thinking along these lines.
Yeah. That's so interesting. I lived in Taiwan for 2 years teaching English when I stumbled upon your show. You were one of the many shows that April and I watched, you know, as inspiration for getting our show up and going. And I remember a while back you said you were an English teacher. Are you still an English teacher? And are the Japanese indoctrinated with the same propaganda as the American public?
I was an English teacher from the time I got here in 2004 until 2011. And since 2011, I've been able to do the website full time, thanks to subscribers and donators and people who buy DVDs. So I'm really blessed. I mean, I pinch myself every day because I know that this is a very unusual situation. So I'm trying to make the most of it. But yes, I mean, having worked, I worked at a private school here for the first few years and then in the public school system for 4 years. And yes, I mean, obviously there is propaganda and indoctrination. I'm not sure it's the exact same flavor and type and subject matter as the American version, but it's, I mean, there are obviously parallels and points of accord. And one that I still remember that really sticks in my mind was when I was teaching in junior high, and the junior high English textbook had this bizarre chapter that was all about, like, it had these really these illustrations of characters that had these bizarre, like, zombified looks on their face, and they're talking about, you know, electric cars or whatever, and they're saying it's good for the earth, it will help the earth, and things like this. And it was so skewed towards a certain type of, I mean, this is the way you learn English, by learning, you know, propaganda buzzwords and things like that. So that was
totally
a moment.
Of course.
Yeah, that was a moment that I realized.
I've had to teach that too. It's very disturbing, you know, to me too. I noticed that too as a teacher, that I would see propaganda in the in the subject matter like that too.
Yeah.
Have you thought about translating your shows or articles into Japanese, or do you do that?
My Japanese wouldn't be up to the task. I can get along in everyday situations, but when it comes to specialized vocabulary, talking about, you know, international geopolitics, I'm a bit out of my league. I suppose I could get my wife to help me, but she's busy enough helping raise our child and working herself, so I don't think she's interested in that. I do have people who do volunteer from time to time to translate various things I've done, and I'm always, you know, appreciative of that, but I don't have any formal system in place for translation. But I don't know. I mean, we're getting to the point where this automatic translation is at least getting good enough that you can make sense of articles in foreign languages more or less now. So, and I'm sure they're working on the next stage. I'm sure they already have the next stage of whatever AI kind of systems for automatic translation and whatever else they're working on behind the scenes in the skunk works of DARPA and Google and what have you. But that will be unveiled to the public slowly, I'm sure.
Yeah, for sure. What is your opinion of the consciousness of the people in Japan? Like, how savvy? And I know you have to kind of generalize, you know, but just from your experience, how savvy do you think they are when it comes to their perspective on the world and how it works?
It is difficult to say because it is there are definitely two levels of society here, I guess you can say, and there's even names for it in Japanese. There's hommae and tatemae, and basically that means what you really think, what you really believe, and then what you show to the outside world. I mean, they're two different concepts, and so there are the things that you're allowed to say in polite society and that, you know, people will say and talk about, and then there are the things that you'll talk about at home with your family kind of thing, and so it's very difficult to get a gauge of it unless you're very close friends with someone. It's hard to have a honest and open conversation. Although, actually, it's usually easier in English because if you're with someone who's interacting in English, maybe they feel it's a little bit different than their Japanese interactions. But still, yeah, a lot of the Japanese society is kind of closed off in that way. So it's difficult to get a gauge. And one of the ways you can get some sort of finger on the pulse of Japanese society is to look at the type of conversation that happens online in internet forums and things, which is increasingly dominated by this type of reactionary, conservative / imperialistic, warlike kind of rhetoric that's coming into vogue online here. And I'm not sure if that's a genuine expression of real underlying Japanese sentiment or just sort of the nature of the way internet discussions work. But certainly with the new prime minister, or not new anymore, he's been in for 2.5 years now, but Abe, who's really trying to fundamentally change the perception of Japan and its self-perception from a fundamentally peaceful nation, which it likes to think of itself since the end of the Second World War, to one that is now ready to change its constitution and start having an aggressive military again. That's a huge shift to be going through right now, and there's a lot of support for that in online forums and things that you don't see in polite society here. I still think it's a bit of a cultural taboo to be warlike and nationalistic in face-to-face interaction, but there does seem to be that underlying sentiment online. So there may be a bit of hommae and tatemae going on there. But yes, I mean, certainly, I think it's like any country, fundamentally. I mean, there is a mixed bag of people who are open-minded and who can see through the propaganda, and then, of course, a lot of people who do not see through propaganda. And it's just, I think fundamentally, like any other country, it's just got its own cultural permutations.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. So what's going on with Fukushima? So is it still leaking? Have they made any attempts to try and fix it? Do you know from your perspective? I mean, because we get different news, you know, than Japanese news. So I'm just curious, what are they saying about it over there?
Yes, well, the fundamental underlying problem at the site is the melted through cores in reactors 1, 2, and 3. And obviously those haven't been dealt with and cannot be dealt with current technology. In fact, the technology really doesn't exist yet to even be able to get a sense of where those cores are. And they've tried various techniques. Of course, they've sent a lot of robots into the reactor buildings that invariably will fail because the radiation is too intense. And they've recently tried some sort of, it wasn't cosmic rays, but it was something like that, to try to image where the reactors are lying, and that was not as successful as they had hoped. So they still don't even really know where the reactors are, and that's the fundamental problem of the whole site. So the leaking is really just kind of the ancillary problem of that. It's the kind of thing that's happening because of that. So you have the groundwater flowing through the site and through the reactor basements that are getting contaminated and then pouring out into the ocean. And so, of course, that continues to go on. And the question of storing that radioactive water continues to be a problem, because not only are the tanks that they're using to store that water leaking, but they're also running out of tanks. So there's that problem. And so now the latest is that they're going to actually start a water decontamination plant in next year. Russia is going to be constructing that through Rosatom Corporation. And I believe that's going to be on site at Fukushima. So they're actually going to have their own water decontamination plant right there on site to deal with that issue. But as I say, I mean, that's only kind of the secondary problem to what is the fundamental problem, which still hasn't and can't really be addressed, which is where the reactors are and how you actually contain that.
Are you guys seeing an increase in disease, thyroid problems or autoimmune? I've heard a little bit, and I've seen some blogs that people are writing saying that the Japanese government is basically covering up, but there are people getting sick. Have you witnessed that yourself?
I certainly haven't witnessed any sort of abnormal amount of disease or sicknesses in my part of the country, but I don't think that would be expected. I'm several hundred kilometers away from Fukushima at this point. In Fukushima Prefecture and the surrounding area itself, there have been there is a screening process in place to screen everyone for thyroid issues, especially children, anyone under 18, because that would be the first sort of round of what we would expect. Using Chernobyl as an example, we would expect a lot of children to start coming down with thyroid cancer within about 5 years of the event. Well, we're now into the fourth year. Wow, time really is flying. And so we are expecting to see some sort of increase in thyroid cancer. So that screening program has been in place. And what it has found has been a 6,000% increase in observed cases of thyroid abnormalities, which could be nascent cancer. And so to put that in perspective, 16 new cases were detected between January and March of this year. And that, I mean, that's a striking figure. But then there are the people who will say, well, that's only because there is an unprecedented screening campaign that's underway right now. I mean, everyone under 18 is being screened and being screened quite vigorously. So all of these cases that would not normally be found, these abnormalities, are being found. So that's the way it's being spun. And I guess you can decide for yourself whether that's a rational explanation or not. But anyway, there is an increase in thyroid abnormalities that are being detected in children right now.
Yeah, it's hard to tell from here because, you know, we just really don't know. I mean, I'm in California. Verstine just moved away from California. She's in Texas now. But here in California, there's a lot of concern about it, even here, you know, that we're getting fallout. But really, nobody kind of knows exactly how much radiation we're actually getting or not. And we have plants in California. We've always had plants here for quite a long time anyway. So who knows if it's Fukushima or if it's just from the ones that we already have existing.
Well, that's an important point that I think needs to be underlined, because the most radioactive site in America, the Hanford site, continues to have leaks and problems. There was a huge problem last year. And let's keep in mind there are a lot of problems with the nuclear industry in the United States that are very similar to the problems that led to Fukushima. So I think this is a very fundamental problem with the nature of the nuclear energy industry itself and the way it's quote unquote regulated in the United States by the Nuclear Regulatory Agency, which doesn't regulate anything. Of course, it's just a kind of green rubber stamp for anything the nuclear energy industry wants. And it's run by energy industry insiders and cronies. So, I mean, these are fundamental problems that I think need to be addressed, not just in Japan, not just in the United States, but really around the world. Because the fundamental thing to keep in mind about radioactive nuclear energy, the way it's been developed, the uranium reactors that are used throughout the world, is it is an adjunct to the nuclear weapons industry. And the types of reactors that are used now are used simply because they are really good at processing the raw materials for nuclear weapons. And that's why you use uranium in reactors, for example, instead of thorium, or much, much less potentially hazardous or world-threatening types of reactor designs. So I think that's something that's kind of the big elephant in the room that really does need to be addressed throughout the world. And unfortunately, the IAEA isn't going to do it, because that really is, again, is an adjunct to the nuclear weapons and nuclear energy industries, with the explicit goal of promoting nuclear energy use. That's actually what the IAEA's mandate is. So of course, they're not going to fundamentally question the industry that they are designed to help promote.
And have you, has this event in any way changed your opinion about whether or not we should use nuclear energy? Because I know a lot of people that consider themselves libertarian, I don't know if you do, but a lot of people who are on the libertarian side kind of say, well, you know, we should be able to do anything that is in the name of the free market. And, you know, certainly nuclear power is one of those things, and we should be able to do it. And, you know, just maybe make it a little safer next time. So how do you feel about using it in general?
Well, there's actually a pretty easy solution to getting rid of nuclear power, which is to get rid of government, or at least government involvement in the nuclear energy industry. The nuclear energy industry is not profitable, would not be possible without the support of government itself. Not only the explicit subsidies that the nuclear energy industry gets, and the backslaps and things like that, but also all of the underlying support that makes it possible, including indemnity so that they don't have to pay in the event of large disasters and things like that, that it's going to be subsidized by the state, exactly as has happened in Japan, where the Tokyo Electric Power Company that ran the Fukushima plant has effectively been nationalized. The Japanese government effectively took it over and assumed the majority of the stocks. So it's now effectively a nationalized company, and of course now a national problem. So the Japanese taxpayers are the ones who are footing the multi-billion dollar bill for the decontamination efforts that are going on right now, which to a large extent are decontamination theater, with people in suits going around scrubbing rocks individually to you know, get the radiation off and things like that, and not really having much of an effect at all. But it's certainly a boondoggle for some people who are making lots and lots of money from this disaster.
And what do you think about Iran's push to have nuclear power, nuclear? Well, I mean, we don't know exactly what they're planning to use it for, but what do you think about that?
Well, there's a couple of things to note. One is that I still think there is no such thing as just nuclear power for the sake of nuclear power. I think any country that's really invested in researching nuclear power has the underlying motive of at least being able to use that for nuclear armament purposes. And it might require, you know, changing around some designs and flipping some switches and getting things a little bit different, but at least the sort of underlying infrastructure is there. So I at this point, let's be clear, even the IAEA acknowledges that there is absolutely no indication whatsoever that Iran has ever diverted any nuclear material to a nuclear weapons project in the last 12 years. So that is explicitly not what's happening right now in Iran. But I think that is ultimately one of the reasons why Iran would be developing the nuclear power potential. And I guess the other question to that is, well, is that so wrong in this age of nuclear powers? Why can, you know, Pakistan and France and the United States and Israel and all these other countries have nuclear weapons, but not Iran. I mean, that's just impossible. Well, obviously, it's a double standard. And of course, the only way to overcome that double standard is to make it a fait accompli and just create a nuclear weapons program, as North Korea learned. Suddenly, they get a seat at the table because, well, it's just a fact. They're now a nuclear power. So there's that aspect to it. The other interesting aspect of it is, where did Iran's nuclear program come from in the first place? Any guesses? Oh, that's right. It was the United States. Yes, under the Atoms for Peace program, which was really a now admitted PSYOP to basically convince the world that nuclear energy is a wonderful thing. So we need to develop these nuclear programs. But it was always a false front for we need to basically familiarize the public with the nuclear idea so that we can make the use of nuclear weapons more palatable to the public. That was the actual thing that they were discussing behind closed doors at the time, and the Atoms for Peace project of sending nuclear, basically research facilities, seeding nuclear research facilities around the world, including in Iran, was part of that propaganda campaign. And that's where the nuclear research center in Iran was, where it came from and how it was founded.
Wow. Yeah, that's an interesting bit of history that I didn't think about. You know, I mean, I remember as a kid, you know, back in the 80s and such, there were people that were saying vax, and there were all these groups that what were they called? Maybe that wasn't it. But it was something about there were all these groups that were anti-nuclear power, and then they all kind of just disappeared, you know. That nobody seemed to really be concerned about it anymore, you know. But now it's a bigger picture. There was a whole agenda to kind of take everybody's mind off of it or paint it as a good thing. Wow, interesting. So,
just on that note, I should say that one of the most startlingly effective places where that propaganda campaign worked was, of course, Japan. The only victims of actual nuclear bombings, it became a huge proponent of nuclear power in the nuclear energy industry, and people ultimately welcomed the nuclear energy industry here with open arms, to the point where 52 reactors now sit. Three of them certainly out of commission, but the rest now offline. But still, 52 reactors have been built in Japan, and it's become a part of the fabric of the energy grid here, which is pretty amazing to think of, considering how opposed the Japanese public was to the nuclear idea in the 1940s and 50s, obviously, and getting it turned around. And when you look into that history, it was CIA plants in the Japanese media who were writing editorials and basically encouraging the public. And it was also part of the Atoms for Peace program, and they did this, you know, wonderful, you know, energy, nuclear energy, it's a wonderful thing, and they did this whole traveling museum exhibit thing throughout Japan that basically got people on board with the nuclear energy idea. So even in the only country to be traumatized by the scar of actual nuclear bombings, it was in fact one of the first foreign countries to really embrace the whole nuclear energy idea.
Wow. Yeah, that's really crazy and quite ironic. I had read about a year ago or something about Monsanto building crops in Vietnam, and I thought, whoa, that's like a lot of nerve. It's just, it reminds me of that.
Yeah.
You can spray them with engine orange and then come back later and say, we're gonna make you food or whatever it is they make. But just to switch gears a little bit, I want to get into your last documentary, The Century of Enslavement, The History of the Federal Reserve, and which is about the modern monetary system here in the U.S. So let's start with a very simple question, but I don't know that many people actually know the answer to this. What is money?
Very, very good question. And, you know, I mean, even I think in our popular understanding of that word, it has been conflated to mean a number of different things. And I think we have to tease those different things out. I mean, when you talk about money, are you talking about physical pieces of paper? I think that's what a lot of people think of when they think of money. Or are you talking about currency? Are you talking about the idea of a store of value? I think there are there are, the best way to think of it is to think there are three different functions of money. One is a store of value, one is a medium of exchange, and one is a unit of account. And it just so happens that at this age where we now are in the United States and most other countries around the world, all three are generally the same thing, and it's generally a national currency that's generally created by some sort of central banking institution. So, and kind of farmed out to the commercial banks in the country, exactly as in the United States in the Federal Reserve example. So the dollar is your store of value. The dollar is your medium of exchange. The dollar is your unit of account. For most people, that's the way they think of it. They don't even think to differentiate those different things. But it leads to some problems, shall we say. So for example, if the dollar is the unit of account, so we measure things in dollars, but the value of the dollar itself changes because it's being either the money supply is expanding or it's contracting, credit is available or it isn't, it's a liquid economy or it isn't. That affects the value of those dollars, but things are valued in dollars. So you have this bizarre situation of not really being able to fundamentally measure the actual worth of what you're earning or what you're spending, because it's in this thing that itself is subject to the market forces that you are trying to measure. So it creates those types of problems. But more fundamentally, of course, when you have the store of value also being the medium of exchange and also subject to those market forces and being manipulated by a central banking system that's expanding or contracting the money supply as the banksters wish, then you run into the problem that a lot of people, unfortunately, are facing right now in the United States, and more so every day, which is saving and your whole life and planning for a retirement, and then suddenly finding that by the time you get there, you've saved up X amount of dollars, which sounded like a lot when back in the 1960s or whenever you started saving. Suddenly, now it's almost nothing. It's pittance because of the inflation. And of course, the dollar has lost 94%, 95%, probably more than that at this point, of its value since the Federal Reserve came into place in 1913. And that means that, well, what do? You have to invest in high return things, because if you're just storing your money in dollars and just parking it in a bank account, you're not going to be able to retire. So you have to invest in the stock market. And of course, that's how they get to inflate the Dow Jones and the S&P to all-time record highs, even when there's absolutely no underlying economic activity that would explain that. So it is all a big Ponzi scheme, and there are a number of different players and a number of different ways that this benefits those players. But fundamentally, it's being directed by this very same banksters who brought the Federal Reserve System into place in 1913.
And that leads us to my next question, because I was going to ask you, you interviewed G. Edward Griffin, who the author of the book Creature from the Jekyll Island and the film, and he talked about the secret meeting at Jekyll Island, and that it was under the guise of duck hunting, but it was actually these elite group of bankers who wanted to create the Federal Reserve. So what happened exactly, or what do we know that happened, and why would they expose their agenda? How did we come to find out about it?
Well, it was November 22nd, 1910, which is interesting because it's 53 years to the day before the President of the United States had his head blown off in broad daylight by a lone nut. And a collection of interesting people met at a railroad station in Hoboken, New Jersey. You had Senator Nelson Aldrich, who was very well known as the quote-unquote general manager of the nation, was how he was often referred to in the press at the time, because he was the head of the Senate Finance Committee, a very influential member of the Senate Finance Committee. And he was also, of course, tied into the Rockefeller family. He was the father-in-law of John D. Rockefeller Jr. So there's those connections and all of those types of connections. So Senator Nelson Aldrich was kind of the linchpin of this. But then he was joined by the Assistant Treasury Secretary at the time, Frank Vanderlip. You had the president of National City Bank, Henry P. Davison, who was also senior partner of J.P. Morgan. You had Benjamin Strong, who was also an associate of J.P. Morgan and the president of Bankers Trust. You had Paul Warburg of the infamous Warburg banking family, based in Europe, obviously. And he was also the son-in-law of Solomon Loeb of Kuhn Loeb and Company. So you had these extremely influential banking interests all meeting in one railroad car in Hoboken to take the trip down to Jekyll Island. And in any in most other circumstances, the press would have been all over that, but especially at that time, because there had been a big crash in 1907, the panic of 1907, which threatened to bring down Wall Street and the banking system of the United States at that time altogether. And so there was this huge debate that was going on in the United States at that time about, well, do we need a central bank, and how should that central bank be formed? And so these people were actually very much in the spotlight at the time. So the idea of these people meeting together in secret would have been the story of the century if anyone had known about it. But they went to unusual degrees of to basically keep this meeting under wraps. So they only went by first names the entirety of the trip, so that even their butlers and whatever wouldn't know who they were or what they were doing. And they met in secret, and they had their curtains closed on their private railroad car as they traveled to Jekyll Island, and all of this, you know, ridiculous secrecy, which worked stunningly well, because it wasn't until I want to say 23 years later that it was finally 100% confirmed by Frank Vanderlip, who you remember was the assistant treasury secretary. He actually wrote about it in the Saturday Evening Post, I believe it was, in 1933, where he admitted, I was as secretive, indeed as furtive, as any conspirator. I do not feel it is any exaggeration to speak of our secret expedition to Jekyll Island as the occasion of the actual conception of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System. So you have the confession in his own words by one of the conspirators. Sorry, it wasn't 33, it was 35 years later. It was the February 1935 edition of the Saturday Evening Post. Although it had been reported on, interestingly enough, by Charles Forbes, Bertie Charles Forbes in 1916, who would, of course, go on to found Forbes magazine. But that was never fully confirmed until 1935. But it eventually was 25 years later, when no one particularly cared or was interested in the story anymore, it was finally confirmed. So another conspiracy theory that I'm sure people would have been derided for at the time, that was fully confirmed by one of the conspirators.
Wow. Yeah, but why do you think he did that? Why did he want to let everybody know about it, you know, and write the piece in the post?
That's a good question. Well, it could simply be hubris. And I think that a lot of the people mm-hmm. who are involved in these types of things want to brag about their involvement in them, because it's a sign of their importance. And certainly it makes a good story. And at that time, by the time that it was actually admitted, it wasn't a political deal. I mean, no one at the time was talking about, well, there were a few people in Congress actually talking about ending the Federal Reserve, but not many. And it wasn't a political issue that most people in the nation were even really aware of at that time, let alone thinking about, doing something about. So I think, obviously, if they had talked about it in 1910, it would have completely and utterly destroyed any chances of them enacting the legislation. If they had talked about it even a few years after the creation, people would have been probably very angry about it. But it's one of those things that one could imagine, 30, 40, 50 years from now, or however long it is, one could imagine some political reality where they come out and say, yeah, you know what, it looks like there may have been some CIA involvement in JFK or something like that. And by that point, I mean, what are people going to do? It's like, oh, well, yeah, I think I remember my grandma or grandpa talking about that, when I was a kid, but he was only talking about what his grandpa had told him. So there comes a certain political distance from these things where it's okay to talk about them and to reveal what's going on. And again, I think people get a sort of sick thrill out of being part of that. I mean, hey, I'm a conspirator. I helped bring about the system. It makes quite a story.
Yeah, it's right. It does. Makes him feel omnipotent, like he was a part of this whole thing, even if it's not necessarily, even if it's maybe evil, on that side of the end. And that's a good point that you bring up too, about the distance thing, because you think sometimes when we see these things happen in history, people are aware of false flags throughout history. They're aware of assassinations throughout history. They're aware of CIA doing dubious things throughout history. And yet, when you try to say, "Well, this is happening now," people would say, "No, that was then. It's not now. That was then." That's kind of an interesting thing that you bring up, because there does seem to be this disconnect that happens where people can kind of think, it's not a big deal that it happened in the past, but it's a big deal that it happens now. But then, that sort of helps. I don't know. Then they don't really see it happening in the present. Kind of interesting. But since the financial crisis of 2008, you know, there were the bankers' bailouts, and there's been some films come out. There was Inside Job with Matt Damon, and there seemed to be some people kind of waking up to things that are going on in this Ponzi scheme. And one of the things you discussed was alternatives to the Federal Reserve monetary system, and like Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, and all of that. So what can you tell us about that? And are you still involved with that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that the only way that we're ever going to fundamentally change the system as it exists is not going to be through some sort of political action. I really don't believe that's going to change anything. I think it's going to come from grassroots efforts to construct an alternative system. And the point that I tried to make at the end of the documentary, it's split into three parts. And the first part is kind of about the history of the Federal Reserve and how it came about. The second part is how it functions, what it actually does. And then the third part is talking about these alternatives and what can be done about it. And the point of that third section wasn't to advocate any one particular idea. It was just to show there are a lot of different ideas on the table, and I think we need to at least start the discussion and educate ourselves about what those alternatives are. So I talked, for example, to Ellen Brown about the idea of public banking. I talked about, as you say, gold and Bitcoin and things of that sort that have often been proposed as sound money, or gold has been proposed as a sound money alternative. And there are other ideas like alternative and complementary currencies as ways of at least starting the baby steps of getting away from that dollar hegemony. And I think that's extremely important in the light of things like what we've seen in Greece, where you have the Greek people who are the same people as they were a few years ago and largely engaged in the same tasks, producing the same things and interacting in the same way and buying the same things from each other. But they can't do so because of a lack of this currency, this euro that the European Central Bank, you know, basically makes possible. That's ridiculous. That's insane. Why are these people being prevented from their interactions and their transactions because of a lack of this currency that has been deemed as the, you know, the legal tender? So you have seen in Greece in the last several years a number of experiments and things popping up with alternative currencies based on let's type programs, on barter even. There's a lot of different alternatives that have been popping up in Greece. And no, they're not all perfectly successful, but to the extent that they are or they aren't generally depends on the amount of engagement and commitment of the people who are using them. So when you're in the midst of a big crisis, it would be really good to have some of these alternatives in place so that you can turn to them in that time of crisis, rather than relying on, you know, the banksters to rain down some paper dollars from heaven on you when it may not be in their interest to do so. And it's a good thing to note that there are already a lot of alternative and community currencies all throughout the United States and around the world. And one example that I highlight in particular is the Ithaca Hours system, an exceptionally successful, probably one of the most successful alternative or community currencies in the world, that was started a few decades ago and is extremely well used in Ithaca. You can not only buy all sorts of local services and retail goods, but you can also go to the hospital. There's credit unions that accept this complementary currency. So it's quite already a valid and viable system. But again, the more people who participate in it, the more likely it is to be something that people can turn to in the event of a crisis, like what we saw in 2008 or whatever is going to come with the popping of the next bubble.
Right, which is probably going to happen, or most certainly going to, the way that the price of oil and everything is going up and up and up. And so were you ever following the stories coming out of Iceland about the story was that there was this debt forgiveness and then all the people were suddenly free. And I think it was kind of idealized maybe a little bit. We didn't necessarily hear the full story. Were you following that at all?
Yes, not as much as I should be. I mean, I can't speak of it with a great deal of authority, but I can absolutely say that the sort of simplistic notion that's sort of put out there sometimes, that Iceland did it right, they put the banksters in jail and forgave all debts and everything's turned out better, I think that's disingenuous in a lot of different ways. I mean, first of all, it's not really a direct analogy to what's going on, for example, in Greece, where in the Icelandic situation, it was you had British banks that were coming in and helping to facilitate all sorts of loans that that eventually got basically the Icelandic banks were over-invested in these CDOs and things that were coming out of the United States that we now know were the subprime toxic garbage. And so they ended up getting in trouble, and this put their outstanding loans in jeopardy and blah, blah, blah. And so ultimately they said they weren't going to pay back the British banks, and ultimately the Icelandic parliament went along with them on that. And then there have been things like certain people have been allowed to get out of mortgage debt and things like that because of, loans that were, I can't think of the word, predatory. But it doesn't apply to everyone. And so there's a lot of caveats to that story. And yes, there have been some bankers that have been thrown in jail. So there are, I think, positive aspects to that. And it does deserve to be looked at as an example. But I don't think it's something that can be directly applied or immediately applied to places like Greece or other places. But it can be at least something that we can sort of study as one way forward or something that can be done. But I think that ultimately the idea of debt forgiveness, that has to be the fundamental underlying idea for a place like Greece, which of course was sold down the river by its political caste, whatever you want to call them, in conjunction with the banksters, because now we know absolutely 100% for certain Goldman Sachs helped Greece cook its books in order to get it in the Eurozone in the first place. Greece should not even be in the Eurozone by the Eurozone's own standards, but they did some magic on the books and suddenly it looked like they were in a lot better financial health than they were. We all know that's a complete lie. We all know that the Greek government has been the one that's been running up this bill that now the average Greek person is being asked to pay. It is an odious debt. It is ridiculous. It is illegal. And in fact, there was a parliamentary committee in Greece that was looking into this very issue that came out with this really startling preliminary report talking about how the debt is odious. It's illegal. It's against, it's a human rights violation to put the Greek people on the line for this debt that was run up by fraudulent and predatory banks, including the ECB and the IMF and the European Stabilization Fund. It was really an amazing report, but of course, absolutely none of that got into the negotiations with the so-called troika between Greece and its creditors. None of that was really brought up. They never really brought up that issue or talked about the idea that this debt itself is illegal and fraudulent and should not be foisted on the average Greek citizens. But of course, that's never going to be brought up in the political game that's being played right now. And it is a political game. And that's, again, why I think the real solution is going to come grassroots. It's going to come from alternative infrastructures that are either participated in and built up by the people, or the people will ignore them and continue going along their merry way and will suffer the consequences when the collapse really hits home.
I'm just curious, what is the official narrative of global warming or climate change, and why are people held on to this, even in the light of the 2009 Climategate discoveries?
It's just a question of who basically controls the propaganda narrative, and it's not hard to see who really does have a large amount of control over that. It's the types of, it's an institutional narrative, really, that's being painted on the climate change front, and that's one that's undergirded by this supposed consensus, quote-unquote, which itself is an ephemera. The more you look into it, the more even the claims of 97% of scientists or 97% of research papers or whatever 97% number they're going to pull out of their hat next week is itself a fraud. And if you look into the story, for example, the original story about the 97% of scientists agree was based on a poll of something of the order of 13,000 scientists. And ultimately, only a small percentage of that even replied to the survey. And of that, there was only, I think, something like 93 or something that were actual climate scientists. So they took the whatever it was, 91 of the 93 or whatever the number was, and said, well, look, that's 97%. So it's a 97% number, which, with so many levels of fraudulent, dissembling going on there. And then in order to save that 97% number, they came out with this new study that took a look at tens of thousands of peer-reviewed papers and found that 97% of them agreed that that man-made global warming was happening. And that story has completely fallen apart because other people picked it apart, not only from the fact that they the ways that the these papers were being counted were highly questionable. In fact, a lot of the authors of some of these papers have been contacted and said, that's not what this paper is about. That's not what we were saying. We don't stand by that. So not only that type of problem, but also if you actually look at the papers that explicitly state that anthropogenic global warming is the cause of what we're seeing, it's something like 0.7% or some ridiculously small number like that. It's just that they get to manipulate their interpretation of what these papers are saying that allows them to say 97%. So, I mean, and they also are keeping the actual data that they used, that they collected on these papers and how they sorted them. They're keeping that secret because, of course, you know, I mean, any process like this is going to be secretive. But of course, the only thing that gets published in the media is 97% of scientists agree. And you have, was it Colbert or one of those funny comedian, political comedian people, having that debate about climate science where they got 97 guys dressed up in lab coats up on the stage versus 3 oil-funded shills to, you know, talk about climate change or whatever. And it makes a great spectacle, and it certainly implants the idea in people's minds, oh, there's a consensus, and therefore it's true, which even in and of itself is a fallacy. But again, I think it's so much about this media perception. Another excellent example of this just happened very recently with Jim Hansen, who, of course, was one of the people who helped kick off this global warming hysteria back in the 80s through admitted fraud and deception. It's interesting if people look into the actual original hearings and some of the ridiculous tricks they played, like turning off the air conditioning in the room in Washington during a heat wave so that people were literally sweating while they were delivering their testimony about this global warming. That was admitted to years later by one of the people who did it. But, you know, silly little tricks like that that have a huge effect on the way people perceive these things, because it's all about perception. But Jim Hansen has basically shifted completely from being a scientist to being an activist, an advocate, and doesn't really even make bones about that anymore. And he recently came out with this paper that's talking about, no, you know, the IPCC just came out talking about the sort of equivocal, maybe there might be a little bit of this type of sea level rise, but no, it's actually going to be so much more. And interestingly, not even the sort of climate change true believers took that very seriously. Basically, he put out a press release about this paper that hasn't been reviewed, and no one's, you know, there's nothing behind it, nothing to it. It's been put out now for an open review, and even in the first couple of days of review, there were dozens of comments from different scientists that were just eviscerating this study that supposedly shows that it's much worse than we thought. But again, of course, the only things that ever get reported are it's much worse than we thought, because hey, that's an amazing headline. That'll sell newspapers, that'll sell advertising for your TV network. But you know what? Actually, things aren't quite as bad as we thought is not as sexy a story and is not going to be run with. And that's even just looking at it from a sort of, you know, dollars and cents perspective, let alone from a, you know, who's really pulling the strings of this agenda perspective.
It seems that the real problem is the, you know, the government allowing the EPA and these things, all these pollutants getting into our environment. Maybe they should focus on that, right? But that's not probably going to happen.
Absolutely. No, there are real, true environmental disasters that are taking place as we speak. All sorts of, I mean, real pollution problems and things of that nature. And let's not even, I mean, how can you even talk about that without broaching the subject of the giant uncontrolled experiment with the genome of the planet itself? That's being run by Monsanto and its various biotech brethren, that is truly threatening to change the entire planet and the future of the entire world. I mean, you can't overstate how important what's happening right now is in this giant open air uncontrolled experiment that's going on. But no, let's not talk about those issues. Let's concentrate on carbon dioxide and how your SUV is basically causing everything. Everything wrong in the world, and we have to sacrifice to the carbon gods to atone for our sins.
Yeah, it's like everything that they create, they always want to put back on us. You know, like your problem, you're a genetic mutant, or you have these issues, and so on and so forth. You're it's your car, it's your breathing, it's whatever. Yeah. You know, but it's like, no, you guys are doing it. You know, but some people in the alternative media and the truth movement, they get into the idea that maybe there is global warming, but it's coming from Harper, it's coming from chemtrails, or it's these types of things. Have you looked into that, or have you seen anything that might be able to cite that as as a possibility?
Weather manipulation and at least the quest for weather control is not a conspiracy. I mean, that's openly admitted and is even talked about in UN treaties and things of that nature. I mean, it's certainly going on, and I have no doubt that it's much more advanced from where it was back in Vietnam, where you had people involved in the program openly bragging that they could cause, you know, typhoons to wipe out the North Vietnamese supply lines whenever they wanted and that type of thing. I'm sure we are at absolute Buck Rogers level by this point in terms of all the black op underground programs that I'm sure they have on the books. But again, that's one of those things that, I mean, we can only ever come back into that from the outside. And again, geoengineering is something that is going on and is being worked on. The only question is the extent to which it's currently being used and what is the components that they're using in their geoengineering mix and all of that. But yes, these things are going on. And I have no doubt that they are to explain, they can explain some of these weather phenomena that we're seeing. But on the bigger picture of global warming itself, I mean, you have, I guess it's all about the scale that you're looking at. If you look at the last 20 years, there hasn't statistically been warming, in fact. And that pause has been now admitted by even the climate change true believers. So that's a pretty sticky position to be in. But they keep changing the goalposts. Before it was like, well, if you have 20 years of no warming, that would be something. And now that it's 20 years, they're saying, well, if you have 50 years, maybe that'll be something. So of course, the goalposts just continue to change. But if you expand out even from there, of course, the world generally is warming, because we're still coming out of the mini ice age that took place a few hundred years ago. And of course, bigger picture than that, we're in an interglacial period where you would expect warming before, of course, the next glacial period where obviously we'll be cooling. I mean, it's all about the perspective of how many years you're looking at. And of course, that's why when they're looking at global warming statistics, generally they'll look at periods that suit their purposes, generally starting in the 1970s, because that's when this latest period of warming took place, but from the 1970s to the late 1990s. And so that's what makes all of these, you know, graphs look really spectacular. But it's all about perception and framing. And again, I mean, if people perceive that the weather is changing, they will see the changes, because what does it mean for weather to be the same? I mean, is the weather always going to be the same all the time? Of course not. There are going to be unusual weather events all the time. Whether or not those unusual weather events are increasing or decreasing is a matter that has to be studied. It's not one that can be perceived, because we are just perceiving the day-to-day weather.
Yeah, you know, it's true. We used to just call it the seasons. Now it's like this, you know, it's global warming or...
Yeah,
or
it's hot this summer. Oh, my God.
Right, it's hot. It's having a drought in California. Well, yeah, because we're in the desert, you know, it's like... that's
kind of... It doesn't rain.
It doesn't rain very much because it's desert around here. So, well, thank you for being on the show today. We're just about out of time, but we've had a really good chat with you, and I'm really honored that you've been on our show. As Christine was saying at the beginning, I don't know, we kind of glided past that, but you were one of the people that we were watching when we were first starting to talk about this radio program, and inspired us to do it. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that. My hats are off to everyone who gets into this conversation and gets in the ring and starts putting this information out, whether they agree with me or not, or what their perspectives are. I really do think that the only way forward is for humanity to start engaging in this conversation rather than just passively watching it from the sidelines. So absolutely, my hats off to you guys for getting involved.
Oh, well, thank you. Very well said. And before we go, please remind our audience where your website is and how they can buy your DVDs, follow you on YouTube, all that.
I'm at CorbettReport.com. That's where you can find my audio and video and articles, all of the information there. It's all up freely available. I have a subscriber newsletter that comes out on the weekends, but that editorial is available on the International Forecaster website at theinternationalforecaster.com. YouTube.com/CorbettReport is my YouTube channel, and basically all the links will be there at CorbettReport.com, and all the information, again, freely available up there for free. Use it as a resource if you like it, and if you're, you know, a follower of mine and you've been watching for some time and you appreciate the information, then of course I do appreciate donations, subscriptions, DVD sales.
Perfect. Okay, well, thank you so much, and please enjoy the rest of your, I don't know what time it is over there, but
11 a.m. The day's still young for me.
Okay. Okay, the day is young. So the rest of your day, and thank you so much. Yeah. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye, Jane.
Bye.